This talk was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold Roshi at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugen Roshi is the abbot of the monastery and the Zen Center of New York City. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or to find out more about our retreats and residency programs, visit us online at zmm.org. Thanks for listening.
This is from The Gateless Gate, case 19. Ordinary mind is the way, the main case. Zhao Zhou once asked Master Nanquan, "What is the way?" Nanquan said, "Ordinary mind is the way." "Then we should we direct ourselves toward it or not?" asked Zhao Zhou. "If you try to direct yourself toward it, you move away from it," said Nanquan. Zhao Zhou said, "If we don't try, then how can we know that it's the true way?" Nanquan said, "The true way doesn't belong to knowing or to not knowing. Knowing is illusion, not knowing is blankness. If you really attain to the Tao of no doubt, it's like the great void, so vast and boundless. How then can there be right and wrong in the way?" At these words, Zhao Zhou was suddenly enlightened. The commentary. Questioned by Zhao Zhou, Nanquan immediately shows that the tile is disintegrating. Ice is dissolving, and no communication at all is possible. Even though Zhao Zhou may be enlightened, he can truly only attain it after studying for 30 more years. The poem. Hundreds of flowers in spring, the moon in autumn, a cool breeze in summer, and snow in winter. When there's no vain cloud in your mind, for you, it is a good season. So today we're concluding our session, and it started on Monday evening. And so I've given a couple talks and speaking a little bit about the path that is spoken of at times as the mountain training, ascending the mountain, reaching the mountain's peak, and then descending the mountain. And so today I want to talk a little bit about descending the mountain training. These are ways of talking about a path that is fundamentally alive and dynamic. And we can, as we do with many things in Buddhism, we can pull out certain aspects and focus on them. And in that way, in our mind, they can begin to take on a kind of object-like nature, something definite, solid. And so we have to constantly be reminding ourselves and be remembering and ultimately realize directly that is, in essence, what delusion is about, is creating solidity, a self where there's only selflessness, of creating a sense of permanence within all that is impermanent. But we must do this as a way to engage, study the teachings, convey them, study, practice them. So Zhao Zhou, yesterday I gave the talk on Zhao Zhou's koan mu, which is a very, sort of, probably one of the most important and famous koans in the Zen tradition. And Zhao Zhou was one of the real luminaries in the Zen tradition, was a Chinese master who began practice very early and came to Nanquan when he was about 18. The koan of mu is something that he was teaching when he was at a very mature age, and dharmically, and also in human age, human years. He lived until he was 120 and was really a student. Part of his gift to us is that he was an example of a great master who was a student all the way through his life. Very inspiring. There's a nice story of when he encounters Nanquan. He somewhere. Well, basically, he came to Nanquan, and Nanquan asked him, "Where are you coming from?" And he said, from wherever he was coming from, I can't remember. And Nanquan said, Are you studying with anybody? And Xiaozhou said, and Nanquan was laying down in bed. He was sick. And Xiaozhou said, yes, I am. And Nanquan said, who are you studying with? And Xiaozhou stepped forward and said, it's so good to see you, Master, and to know that you're doing well, even though you have a cold. I mean, how could you not fall in love with such a person? And it said that Nanquan knew right away that this was a that this student had a potential, a particular potential. So this is a very important koan because it, descending, the idea of descending the mountain is that when you're ascending the mountain, then you haven't reached the peak, you don't know what's ahead of you, you get entangled in briars and you lose your way on the path seems to disappear at times and you have to find your way back. And there are all sorts of challenges and hurdles that you have to encounter. It's the great journey. And all of that, of course, is our karmic dispositions, it's our attachments, it's the self, it's life challenging us in so many ways. And trying to continue to find our way forward, to take that next step within the Dharma as a practitioner, and to bring all that we're studying and all that we're developing into that very moment, into that encounter with whatever that obstacle is, so that we begin to understand more and more what is obstruction, what is suffering, what is the three worlds or mind. And that shift, that revolution from externalizing all the sources of our suffering, at the same time that we acknowledge that there is much suffering in the world, and there are many sources, there are many causes of our own pain and discomfort. But pain and discomfort in our experience is happening within. It's not happening somewhere else. And so reaching the peak is the point you've risen above the tree line, everything has dropped away, the view is boundless, the air is clear and pristine, and you can see in all directions. There are no more obstructions. And you're alone. Alone on the summit. But the path continues, because it is an endless path. And so what happens when you're at the top of the mountain and you need to keep going? You go down the other side. And so you return. And so that metaphor of using the mountain and the journey as a way to return to everything that from the summit you can't hear the noise and the honking and the phone calls and the you don't see the bills piling up. None of that's there. You know, it's all unreachable. Right? It's unreachable because the self has been realized as empty. Because on that summit, there is nothing apart. There is no differentiation. No communication whatsoever is possible. Wu Men is describing the tile disintegrating, ice dissolving. As Dada Roshi said, this body is so vast and boundless, it can only acknowledge itself. And so then, but the bodhisattva path is to not understand liberation as being distinct from the world, because that's just another duality. And so how do we realize non-duality? How do we attain true peace within the multitude, the noise, the worries? And so we can think of this as a kind of transformation. Right? And so on that path of transformation, there is developing understanding. I talked about being true to oneself as being true to the Dharma. We have to understand what the Dharma is, what it teaches, if we're going to practice it well. And so right understanding we can think of as being in the leaves and the branches of the tree. As we begin practicing meditation, developing mindfulness, cultivating samadhi, beginning to gain understanding, letting go more and more of our attachments, we can think of that as hugging the trunk, being the trunk. Reaching the summit and then moving back into the into the world, into our lives, into the world of discriminating consciousness, is the roots. What is the way? Nanquan says, ordinary mind is the way. What is the way means what is the Dharma, what is true? What can I take refuge in? What is the immutable, unchanging truth of things? And truth not as in something decreed, not as in something, an absolute, but that when encountered directly and embodied, integrated into one's life, is an expression of harmony, of peace, of being free of hindrance and conflict. It is not transformation in the sense of being something and transforming into a new being of something. And so the way also means the path, the Eightfold Path. But what is that ultimately? Again, because as soon as we begin talking about the path, it's like do this, do this, understand this, practice this. It's like a lot of tasks. And we obscure or sort of distort and lose that sense. It was said so nicely about Trungpa Rinpoche that the path is more like you're falling out of a parachute. What at first appears as bad news is that you're falling out of a plane. And what appears as bad news in the beginning is that you have no parachute. What we don't yet understand is the good news is that there's no ground. And so monasteries, forms of practice, eight gates, eightfold path, teachings, teachers, all of these have one nature, empty and free. When we attach to them, just as when we attach to anything else, they begin to become dull and lifeless. They lose their vibrancy. They become something. And as soon as they become something, they can become something that irritates you, that are not satisfying you, that are not fulfilling your expectations. But it is not this. Shibayama in his commentary said, if the Tao is literally our everyday mind as it is, ordinary mind is the way, Nanquan said, then everyone everywhere would all know this. And we wouldn't have to wait for teachers and the ancestors and wise ones to come and teach and guide us. This means that we have to transcend our ordinary mind to attain the true ordinary mind. And in order actually to transcend our dualistic ordinary mind, sincere searching and dedicated application of effort are required. When we've broken through the barrier where our ordinary mind is no longer ordinary, we can for the first time return to our original ordinary mind, which Nanquan is upholding for us to see. And so Dogen says, mountains are mountains and rivers are rivers. The meaning of this is that mountains are mountains, but that mountains are mountains. Another way that this is expressed is that in the beginning, mountains are mountains. That the more we practice and see beyond the appearances of things, we realize mountains are not mountains. And then ultimately, as we return home, realizing we've never taken a step, we realize once again, mountains are mountains. It's exactly what Shibayama is saying. Finally, having let go of our ordinary mind and realizing ordinary mind, realizing ordinary mind is not ordinary, then we can return to ordinary mind. And it's not the same, and it's not different. Having tried so hard to change, we see from the beginning that the whole idea of change undergoes a profound revolution in terms of how we understand that. In the Oxfordian picture verses, or the Oxfordian verses, it says, talks about seizing the ox, seizing the self with a terrific struggle, realizing the self. And yet still, its power and great will are inexhaustible. That even having reached the peak, having realized the ox, which is self-nature, and beginning to move down, the ox is still very willful, very powerful. We don't understand how powerful it is. We think seeing it clearly is enough. But if you look at the pictures, you see that seeing it, that what's depicted is the rump. Right? It's the ox. But in a sense, and that's not even true what I was going to say. So I was going to say, in a sense, we're seeing a part of it. And then more and more we see the whole thing. But that's not true. We're seeing the whole thing, and the whole of the ox is not yet clear. And it can be hard to understand. I remember struggling for so long to understand, how can that be true? How can you see it and have that clarity and yet have the clarity not be clear, not be fully clear? It's not yet understanding the nature of this ox. And so through endless, ceaseless, ongoing practice, and the returning over and over, day by day, to all that practice is, it becomes more clear. You know, it's kind of like that story that the Buddha told of, you know, in trying to discern self-nature, the way, that you've got four or five people who are, the way is an elephant. And so each one has grabbed a different part of the elephant, the trunk, the tusk, the tail, the flank. And so each one, and they're all blind. So each one is describing the elephant, right? But they just have a piece of it. And so that's a way of saying how it's a false view, right? But another way of saying that, so it's sort of like reducing the path to just meditation, right? Or to just liturgy, or to just dana, right? To any of the practices that are all part of a path which is inclusive, whole, and integrated, and trying to realize the path within just one of those, in other words, separating it out. It's part of the challenge or the sort of issue with the whole mindfulness movement from a Buddhist perspective. But another way of looking at that is to say, yeah, but each person is holding a piece of the elephant. That's not false. They may not have put their hands on the whole body of the elephant yet, but they do have a piece of it. And if they keep practicing, sort of like you keep working your way up into the whole. The Oxford verses going further say, the whip and rope are necessary. So the student has a whip and a rope, else the ox might stray off down some dusty road. Being well trained, it eventually, naturally becomes gentle. Now unfettered, it easily moves along. The whip and the rope are patience, perseverance, faith, commitment, skillfulness, resilience. And it's a way of saying that sometimes we have to be demanding and hold ourselves accountable, be held. It's part of what the commitment of training is about. It's about this part of the discipline of being in the Zendo is to be held and to hold ourselves, right, within the willfulness of this mind, within the willfulness of our own karma, right, the strength of all of those impulses, right, which want to dominate and want to maintain control. And so sometimes we have to hold ourselves and be held so that we can allow all of those energies to begin to calm as we see into them. And as we see into them, we realize they're not what we thought. A revolution is underway. At other times, we need to be very gentle and forgiving. So sometimes we hold that rope tightly. Sometimes we give it lots of leash. And that's just another way of saying that practice is not a rule. The Buddha has no fixed form. In truth, what we're learning is how to be ever attentive to what we're experiencing in this moment, so that we can more and more skillfully practice this moment. And so on the path of non-attachment, what does it mean to not attach now? Now. Now. You can't just apply a rule to that. And as the path unfolds, it unfolds in accord with the way, which means, from our conditioned perspective, unexpectedly. You know, all of us, I think, in some way, even though we may not be conscious of it and we might not own up to it, in the beginning have a pretty decent idea of how this whole thing's going to work out. You know, I mean, maybe that's what gives us the faith to start. It's like, yeah, I know it's going to be hard, and I know this and that, but it's like, I've got this, you know. And we don't. You don't have a parachute. And really, in all of those moments when our ideas and expectations meet the reality, those are like the moments of pivot, in a sense of determination, of which path do I take? What will I trust right now? And as that continues to unfold, what's very interesting is often what motivates us in the beginning shifts, because often, for most people in the beginning, what motivates us is suffering, right? In all of its forms, any of its forms, each of us based on our own lives, our own karma, and the world that we live in, and how all of that comes together. And as practice is working, as we are ascending the mountain, as we are in the midst of that revolution, oftentimes those initial sources of motivation shift. They're not the same. Sometimes they drop away in a very significant ways. And those can be very interesting and important periods in a person's life, and can also be a period of floundering, wandering, and wondering, of not quite knowing what it's about, because it's been about this for so long, and that this has been so tangible and palpable and immediate. This is why in the Guardian Council and in, you know, our training of inquiry and discernment and asking why now, why this, right? You don't have to do this. Why dedicate this time of session, of this morning, right? Of committing to being a student, of wanting to live your life as a monastic, right? The world is vast and boundless. You can do all kinds of things. Why? And the purpose of that is to try and help each person reach that deep place within themselves that they can draw upon and take refuge in all the moments that become unclear, where the determination is flagging, where their clarity is not clear, where their energy is not available, where it doesn't make sense. And all to have today. To have today. The last of the Oxfordian pictures is barefoot and naked. I mingle with the people of the world. My clothes are ragged and dust-laden. I'm ever blissful. I use no magic to extend my life. And now before me, the dead trees become alive. And if you look at that portrait, it's just an old, sort of dusty, ragged person. No razzle-dazzle. No shine. They pass you by and you might not even notice. Ordinary mind is the way. Simple and unadorned, standing in the midst of wonder, being wonder itself. All that was dead has now come to life. All of this world that we see and observe and experience as inert, lifeless, comes to life. As Bodhidharma said, all that formerly appeared to be false, we now realize as possessing its own truth. You know, I was thinking as I was working on this and sitting with this during the week, I was thinking about, and I was talking a little bit yesterday about sort of early parts of my life and path. I was thinking about people that I encountered. Of course, I didn't think of it this way. I had encountered Buddhism, but that in essence had some aspect of that ordinary mind. Ordinary people, simple people that I encountered that possessed something within their being that caught my attention and that in that way inspired me, sometimes not even knowing it until afterwards. And I started working when I was very young and you know, I was a kid, so I was doing, you know, manual labor, you know, construction and cleaning and, you know, working in the kitchens of restaurants, all kinds of stuff, mopping floors. Mopping floors seemed to be a theme in my life for many, many years. I remember at one point thinking, I wonder if I'm going to be like 60 and 70 and that will like be still part of my job. So I encountered all kinds of people, you know, people that were outside of my ordinary circle, my sort of social, economic world. And some of those encounters were some of the most important sort of moments of education growing up. But I was remembering a family that my own family got sort of intimately connected with through a whole story of my brother, but a family in northern Georgia, very rural, very small farming community, and a family that we sort of mutually befriended each other and spent time together, and only about an hour and a half north of Atlanta, but a very, very different world. And so I spent time there living with this family, working on their farm, Mary and B.L. Kinney. And I was thinking about how one morning she made breakfast and she made biscuits and they were like, you know, incredible biscuits. And I said, and I made a joke and I said, you know, Miss Kinney, I was on the highway coming up and there was a sign that said, Miss Kinney's biscuits, the best in the world. And she looked really like upset and worried and said, there was a billboard with my name on it? And I felt like such an idiot because I realized, like, she's living in a very profound world where she has this great wisdom about her world, which is all about everything that she touches on a self-sufficient farm. And she was in her late 60s. I was 20. She seemed very old. I was about 19. She was probably in her 60s, maybe late 60s. But she had a wisdom about her, which was part of what was so inspiring to me. And I realized that that my joke was kind of this sort of cynical, sarcastic, you know, this sort of, that was not of her world, and it was upsetting her. Like, what are you talking about? My name's on a billboard. And it, like, took forever to, like, reel that back. I was just kidding. Kidding? What do you mean kidding? Like, what kind of joke is that? It was like, oh my God, get me out of this. But it was such a moment where I thought, what was that? Like, where is my head? And where is my world? And what is her world? And it wasn't like, you know, mine was right and mine was wrong and hers was right. But I just realized it was an encounter, a kind of clash of two worlds that got my attention and gave me pause and made me wonder about the different worlds. And I was thinking about this ordinary mind in terms of feeling like I was experiencing her and the families that I was living with, the people I was living with, as examples in very uncontrived, uninformed, non-Buddhist ways. I remember every day we'd work a full morning. It was a hen lane, egg lane farm, hard work. And we'd work a full morning and then come up for the main meal, dinner, which was amazing. No spices, but just very simple food, but really good. And so it was a big meal. And then we just, and there wasn't a lot of talking, you know, just simple conversation. And then afterwards, we'd all clean up, and then we'd just go sit out on the front porch. And we'd just sit there. And I remember the first couple of times, it's like, now what do we do? And we just sat. Very simple. And every once in a while, somebody might say something. I have to go into town tomorrow. In silence. A few minutes later, I'll give you a list. A few things to pick up. And then silence. It was just sitting. Not talking about the news. Not a rule of silence, just quiet. There was something about that. And that their lives were, it was the first experience I had of a life that seemed whole. Whole in the sense that I couldn't find any categories or divisions within their life. They didn't get up and go to work. And not just because they worked where they lived, but they're just, that wasn't the world view. That wasn't the day's view. We just woke up to the day. And at each moment, this is the mind of this moment. This is the task at hand. And you take care of that task at hand. There was much to do, but there was always time enough. It was interesting. There was so much to do, but there was always time enough. I never had the sense, and I never heard them speak about not having enough time. And I was thinking about that in terms of so many of our lives, right? As we hold the tail of technology and don't know whether to hold on or let go. And so how within our lives do we live simply? And really reflect on how we are training in that at every moment. That's what training is. It's not reducing things to a basis of simplicity. It's realizing life is unfolding within simplicity. Each moment is just one moment. In Dada Roshi's commentary to this koan that takes place in the treasure of the true Dharma, he says, ordinary mind is perfect and complete. It is self-contained, self-fulfilling. It is its own accomplishment. That's what I'm calling simplicity. And so think about what training is. I mean, part of the role of the schedule is to not just organize the day, but it's also to allow each moment to just unfold as it is. We don't have to think about or worry, right, about what's next. Just now, the next moment will arrive. That forethought had to take place and has to take place, right? So we give time to that. That's ordinary mind that takes the form of planning. But in each and every moment, when it is allowed to be just that moment, it is self-contained and self-sufficient. It's not reaching back into the past. It's not worried about the future. It's not comparing this one to the next one. That Arusha says, since it has existed before the kalpa of emptiness, it cannot be attained. That's why you can't keep it. It doesn't belong to us. It's not about belonging. It's not about possessiveness. Since it transcends time and space, it's always in the eternal present. You know, since the beginning of encountering the Dharma, certainly since my coming here, you know, I heard, you know, there's only this moment. No past, no future. And I thought, okay, I can understand that. I mean, the past is, you know, an idea in my mind. The future is an idea in my mind. I sort of get that. And so there's only this moment. But I would say, I do say, that over all of these years, the truth of that is continually revealing itself to me. more and more. Something that in the beginning seems so simple and elemental and is. And because it's so simple and elemental, it is vast and boundless. And that is the wonder of ordinary mind, of simple. Simple as in self-sufficient and self-contained, unadorned, uncontrived. I mean, really, that's what we're striving to practice. Everything that arises that we let go of it is, in a sense, is all of the contrivance. Everything we would add on, pile on, adorn, ornament. Why? Because this moment's not enough. It's just not. It's just like, whoa, this is like really, you know, I need more. And so we get our more. And it's like, oh, okay, this is good, but it's not enough. I need some more. I need some more. And the Buddha said, that spinning knows accumulation. That's what it knows. You will not succeed, the Buddha said. You will not succeed on a path that leads to tranquility, peace. In Dongshan's five ranks, the fourth rank of merging. Ordinary mind is another way of speaking of suchness. Dogen speaks of body thusness, mind thusness, cloud and rain thusness, walking, sitting, standing, lying down thusness, sadness thusness, joy thusness. Ordinary mind is this. It is every moment thusness. We realize it or we don't. It's alive and vital within us, or it seems distant. It seems distant and far away. But it is the reality of every moment. That's why we practice ordinary mind. That's what practice is. Everything we do, we just talk about it. We say, pay attention to each moment. It's just a more sort of instructive way of saying, practice ordinary mind. How? Well, where are you? What are you doing? So when you're taking off your shoes, thusness. And we can hear that and it seems very trivial. It's like, oh, come on. Really? The world's on fire. You bet your ass it is. So what are we going to do about that? How do we find our way in to understanding setting the world on fire? How do we stop setting the world on fire? Ordinary mind is the way. We can't know it. That's what Nan Kuan is saying. When you strive to move towards it, you move away from it. But then Nan Kuan says, but how will I know if I encounter it? And that's an honest question. If I don't know, then maybe I'll pass it by. Right? Like it's a signpost on the road. But when we encounter the way, we realize the way reaches everywhere. It can't be passed by. And so he says, not knowing is blankness, blank consciousness, attachment to nothing. Knowing is just grasping at perceptions. The way is free of knowing or not knowing. Ordinary mind is free of knowing or not knowing. Every moment of judgment, every moment of comparison, in such a moment, just check in and see, where are you now? And what you'll find is distant. When you're bored, where are you in that moment? Distant. Distant from what? From this very moment. From ordinary mind. And because that this moment is all-inclusive, it includes everything, That's really important, because just being present in the moment, when it's not being present to the moment, can actually be a way of denying the moment. So the moment appears, I don't like what I see, so I'm going to concentrate my mind on the moment. Right? I call it the breath. Ordinary mind, but it's not. I just denied that actual moment, because I don't yet understand that this moment is all-inclusive. It's not what I want. It's what it is. And so the fourth rank says, when two blades cross points, don't withdraw. There's no need to withdraw. Barefoot and naked, I mingle with the people of the world. This is really what it all comes down to. Mingling with the people of the world. With all of those people in your mind, all of those many beings, and all of the other ones. My clothes are ragged and dust laden, and I'm ever blissful. And this blissful means not seeking another time, not seeking another place, not seeking another situation. Ordinary mind is self-sufficient, self-contained, all-inclusive. Therefore, there is no more need for magic, for fantasy. I don't need to live forever. You know, it's funny, this idea that if we could just live forever, it would be incredible. Really? It would just be forever of this. I mean, and besides, we need to make room. No need for magic. And that's very much a part of the Zen tradition. Right? Stand on the ground. Sit up straight. Open your eyes. Face forward. And now the dead trees become alive. Hundreds of flowers in spring, the moon in autumn, a cool breeze in summer, and the snow in winter. One moment, one season, one lifetime. When there's no vain cloud in your mind, vain in Buddhism means self-arising. It doesn't just mean I am the best. It's just the sense of self. When there's no vain cloud, no sense of self as distinct and separate in your mind, for you, this is a good season, a good life, a good world. And good means self-contained, self-fulfilling, its own accomplishment. And sometimes that moment which is self-contained is going to try you hard. But when you're not seeking another place, another situation, there's peace. This moment, it's the only one you've got, and it's already passed. So I'll end with a poem. Upon hearing the words, I entered into their meaning. Practicing their meaning, I realize I no longer understand. Again and again, moving towards, moving away, understanding fails ever more perfectly. My understanding fails ever more perfectly. Words. Have you seen the highest branches of the maple tree out front dancing so joyously in the summer breeze?
Thanks for listening. You can find more Dharma Talks, interviews, and events at zmm.org/media. While online, please check out the Jizo Project, our multifaceted initiative to make Zen Mountain Monastery more accessible and welcoming to all. Learn about the new Jizo House building and accessibility enhancements to existing facilities that are just two aspects to this exciting endeavor. Find out more and see how you can get involved at zmm.org/JizoProject. That's JizoProject.